Good afternoon. Thank you for being here this afternoon. I'm Kelsey Pritchard with the Governor's Office. Just a reminder for everybody on the phone, to mute your line, press star 6, and to unmute, press pound 6. And I will turn it over to the Governor.
Good afternoon. Thanks to everyone for joining in on the press conference. I just finished with the budget address, and I hope there's questions and interest, and so I'll just open up for questions. I don't have a statement other than I think the budget tries to offer a proposal to help our ongoing expenditure opportunity be enhanced by strategic use of one-time dollars.
Governor, how much could you not have done without the $70 million? I mean, before you knew you had the $70 million, how conservative or how tight was this budget as far as state government employee salaries, education funding? I mean, what were you looking at without the $70 million?
Before we knew we had the increased unclaimed property dollars that arrived in early November, we were trying to look at how we could produce a budget that would support the 1.6 inflationary increases that K-12 required and that Medicaid providers would be receiving under the approach we've traditionally used. And we've tried to provide salary increases for state employees at those same levels, but just doing those things and meeting the federal medical assistance percentage change and other entitlement growth, we were still $20 million short of having enough ongoing revenue growth to even do that. So probably what would have happened, as I mentioned in the speech, we would have probably had to suspend the transfer to Building South Dakota, and even then I don't know that we would have enough to give 1.6 to those traditional providers or those traditional recipients, and that included nothing for the Board of Regents, nothing for the Technical Institute, so it would have been very difficult to do even what the statutory levels were directing us toward.
Did you, just to follow up, did you think it was the right thing to look at spending all $70 million in one-time funds? I mean, you basically laid out a plan to use it all or most of it. I mean, is that, do you think that's the right thing to do if it's just one-time fund to use it when you have it?
Well, I think in earlier budgets, I have in some cases left money unspent as part of the budget, but that was because there was somewhat more uncertainty about what would happen at the federal budget level. Now that the tax increases occurred at the end of last year, the debt ceiling has been raised, the sequester occurred, and we've been able to manage through that to some degree. There's less uncertainty, so I think there's less expectation that we need to have dollars in reserve. I also think the statutory duty that I have is to start the conversation with a specific proposal. And so to the extent that I leave money unappropriated or unallocated or have no suggestions for the expenditure, I'm not really doing my full job, because every good discussion begins with a specific proposal. If you don't have a specific proposal, then the discussion is all over the board, all over the place, and it's very hard to gain consensus. The best approach to any decision is to have one party present a specific proposal and have those others who participate in the decision react to that, amend that, replace this or that within it. Yes.
What exactly, which programs are you absolutely married to that at least go this way, and which, is there wiggle room at all for lawmakers to say, let's get rid of this and add?
Well, I presented what I think is the best approach, but as I've said in the past, it's a plan. It's not the plan. I'm open to alternative approaches. I do think the approach that we're taking with the one-time money, using it in a way that creates ongoing funding that can be relied upon in the future with relative confidence. I think that makes sense, especially when you look at those groups like K-12 education, Medicaid providers who've had to accept one-time money in the past. They're happy to get the one-time money, but in the next breath they say, we'd rather have ongoing money. You can't pay better teacher salaries with one-time money. You could give a bonus maybe, but you can't pay ongoing salaries. You can't pay nurses' aides a better salary. You can't meet ongoing utility expenses except for the 1 year when you get one-time money. If it's a base, ongoing in the base, then you can plan for the future and it helps you meet ongoing needs better. So that's the approach I try to steer toward and try to figure out ways to utilize the one-time money in ways that created ongoing improvement.
So, Governor,
Stand by online. We got one more question here, and then I think it was David.
So I have two questions real fast. The first is just, can you explain the details, and this might be for Commissioner Dill, just about how you can use the one-time money in an area that was going to be where ongoing funds were going to be dedicated, but that frees, I mean, this concept of freeing up the right account. If you could just break that down for us.
Sure. There's two main ways where use of one-time money helps the ongoing situation. The first way is by pre-funding Building South Dakota with one-time money instead of carving out 25% of the unclaimed property, which is ongoing source. And not only would following the funding approach that was originally conceived be tough in FY15, but in FY16, the carve-out of unclaimed property goes from 25% to 50%. So not only would FY15 be ongoing expenses be constrained because of loss of revenue. It's sort of, imagine that you've got a sum of money with which to pay expenses, but then you take that sum of money and next year you have to carve out 25% of it and set it aside and still try to increase your expenses with only 75% of what you started. And then the following year, you carve out still another 25%, and you're left with 50% of that sum. That's what happens in the statutory funding approach to paying money into Building South Dakota. It carves out 25% of the unclaimed property in FY15 and carves out 50% in FY16. And because that's a fairly large amount of our increased ongoing money, it's especially unfortunate that that's where the best increases are coming from, because that's every increase relates in an increased carve out. So the first way that we improve ongoing is we depart from that approach to funding Building South Dakota. Instead of carving out 25%, we just take a chunk of one-time money and put it in the program, and it's a pretty healthy chunk. And that should carry the Building South Dakota program for several years. At the rate that we're getting applications and applications are being improved, it might carry it for 3-4 years. And in the interim, as we have other income, our one-time dollars, we could still add more to Building South Dakota. So we're not abandoning it by any means. In fact, we're pre-funding it early with a pretty good sum. But by changing the funding approach, then those ongoing unclaimed property dollars that would have been carved out to fund Building South Dakota, they remain available instead for other uses like K-12, border regions, Medicaid, and so on. So that's the first way in which one-time money improves the ongoing situation. The second way uses one-time dollars to pay off bonds, prepay bonds. It's sort of like if you've got your home mortgage and you get an inheritance. It's one-time chunk of money, but every month you've got a $1,000 mortgage payment. But if you take that one-time money and pay off your mortgage, then every month thereafter you've got $1,000 to spend somewhere else, and it's going on. Because it's money you were already getting in, you're already dedicating it to something else, if you remove that expense permanently, then suddenly that income is permanently available for other uses. So that's the second way that we use one-time money, pay off prepay bonds, and then we avoid the principal and interest payments that the general fund had been paying over the past several years and would otherwise have to continue to pay till those bonds matured.
So based on that, can lawmakers change all of that within the general bill, or will there be additional legislation that has to be passed to alter the way that Building South Dakota is funded, for example?
The latter. There will have to be a separate bill to change the way Building South Dakota is funded. Good question. Thank you.
I believe there was a question on the phone.
Several questions, but just building off of that first, subject of Building South Dakota, are you proposing a permanent change to permanently remove the ongoing unclaimed property revenue for Building South Dakota, or simply suspending that for several years and then activating that again?
My preference would be permanently changing it, but I recognize that there are a lot of people who invested a lot of time and effort into creating Building South Dakota, some of whom might feel strongly about maintaining an ongoing funding source, albeit suspended for a period of time. And so I'm not fixated on one approach. We have to recognize that even though we put something in statute, a legislature the next year can change it. So even a temporary suspension can become another temporary suspension or a resumption, depending upon what the nature of the revenue and expense picture is when that suspension would otherwise end.
If I recall, Governor, last year in Building South Dakota was developed, you were never a big fan of the carve-out from the unclaimed property, and then this year you found a mechanism that involves getting rid of that at least for a few years, if not permanently. Was this an opportunity that you were glad came up?
No. I talked with some of the sponsors of Building South Dakota last year about my concern about the carve-out and my worry that, given modest revenue projections, it might impair our ability to meet the inflationary improvements that we would normally make in K-12 and Medicaid and other areas. And there was an understanding between me and sponsors that this something like this might have to be done even as early as now. And there was a commitment on both our parts that we would work together to find a mutually satisfying solution. And I remain of the belief that we will.
Any other questions on the line?
I've got more if no one wants to jump in.
I'm happy to take one from you, David, and then I'll pass it back. How about that? Governor, you specifically stated in your speech that you've chosen not to expand Medicaid to fill the gap of South Dakotans that will not be eligible either for the ACA online opportunity or for Medicaid as it's offered right now. And we've heard a lot about it. We've heard you talk about it. But I'm just wondering if you just said, you know, a legislature could pass something one year and then take it away the next, if the reason to not expand that is instability, but you're moving forward on making other preparations to ensure that, you know, as Medicaid grows, because people will be pushed toward it, will support it, why not the Medicaid expansion? Why would we look at the budget numbers and be okay with projecting higher for the use of current Medicaid, but then not account for that in this legislative session and instead wait it out further to see if the implementation of the Affordable Care Act becomes more solid?
Well, I think, first of all, we are already spending almost $40 million on Medicaid increases. And remember, the total revenue increase for the fiscal year 2015 with the one-time uses that create additional opportunity is $78 million. Of that $78 million, the ongoing increase is sucked up, nearly $40 million of the $78 million is taken up by current Medicaid alone, current Medicaid. Now, the federal government says we will cover all of the costs of expansion. They won't cover administrative costs, so we'll have to assume that. and then within a couple, 3 years, we would start to assume 5% of that cost, and then 6%, and then so on, up to 10%. Well, that's a large number. If you consider we're at 116,000, and we'd add, say, 28,000 to that number, and that 28,000 are adults. Most of the 116,000 are low-cost children. They don't cost a lot. But these are people that are more costly. Adults are, by their nature, more costly, more medical expenses than children, typically. So I just feel there we are constrained enough with the current situation we have already. And those people that are relying upon state government already that have a dependence, whether it be K-12 or people serving Medicaid clients or state employees or the Board of Regents and students who go to college, they're already feeling we're underfunded. Ask them. I'm sure they'll confirm they feel state needs to do more. Well, if they want to preserve our ability to do more, even very modestly more, to add still another entitlement burden on the state really makes it very difficult to realistically promise, yes, we'll continue to provide inflationary increases. I don't think we could promise it and keep it.
Is that something that you would consider then in the future, or is this simply something that you're saying is generally off the table as far as looking to include that 20 to 40,000 group of people?
I think it depends on our picture in the future. I'm not saying never. I'm saying not now. I think it still remains not now.
Governor, just to follow up, though, I mean, it does seem like it's kind of a tough sell in, from the standpoint of you have a lot of people that if you say expand Medicaid and help more people, most people seem to think that's a pretty good idea. But how do you explain it to people so that they don't think state government is being heartless and cruel to people that might be able, that need Medicare? I mean, how do you make that argument that people can understand it and not just dollars and cents?
Well, first of all, I start with the 48,000 who would be covered under an expansion. Of those 48,000, about 22 qualify to go on the exchange once it's working well, to go on the exchange and receive subsidy up to 98% of the, or they'd have to pay only 2% of their income at the lowest levels. And people that are 101% of the poverty level, they'd be paying 2% of their income, regardless of what that income is. So that's relatively modest. So there are people who can go onto the exchange right now, in this $48,000 group. We say, oh, they can't get insured. No, that's not correct. 22,000 of them can go on the exchange today, right here in December 2013, and buy insurance and be subsidized for it today. And some of those will pay only 2% of their income. And sure, they're not making much, but 2% of not much is still less. So that's one answer. Of the other 28,000, if, let's say it's a single adult, if that single adult works 30 hours at minimum wage, they'll be over 1%, they'll be over 100% of the poverty line, and they will also qualify to go on the exchange today. Now, these are not people that have disability, because we cover disabled people. They're not old, frail people. We cover frail elderly. They're not children. We cover children. These are adults that are not disabled, and if they work 30 hours at the minimum wage, they will, as a single adult, be over 100% of the poverty line and qualify to participate on the exchange and get subsidized. So what part of the 28,000 below 100% is represented by that group? I'd like to know that. Also, let's say it's a person who's a Native American. Some of those are considered uninsured, but in fact qualify for medical services at Indian Health Services. Now, if they don't get adequate services at Indian Health Services, then surely the federal government has failed the Native Americans in our nation in that regard. They have failed them. Then the tribe can pay for a modest amount for their members to be covered. No deductible, no copay, a very modest amount for the tribe. So I say, well, if it is government role, if it's government's role to cover its citizens, I think it's fair to say we should engage in the discussion which government in that case. If the federal government won't cover through IHS correctly, maybe the tribal government can pay a small amount and get their members enrolled, whether those members live on the reservation or off. Imagine the state covers some of those people on the reservation. Coverage does not equate to access. It's the same problem with IHS. If I'm covered by IHS and I live on the reservation, so what? IHS provides no good coverage. So if I'm covered by Medicaid and I live on the reservation, so what? I don't have access. There's no doctors there. So it seems simpler than it is.
Do you see the uncovered property?
You could,
stand by, David. One more here, and then we'll go to you.
Can you have that microphone right there?
Do you see the unclaimed property that was found almost like winning the lottery for the state of South Dakota now that we have this extra money?
It was certainly much more than we expected. And in some ways, I think it was... Well, in part, we knew we'd get a one-time bump this year because of changing the rule that unclaimed property is deemed abandoned now after 3 years instead of five. So imagine I'm Dennis Dugard, and I set up a bank account in 2008. Now, under prior law, it would be in 2013, 5 years later, that if the bank couldn't find me, I set up the account in 2008, and then I move out of state, and I don't leave a forwarding address, and the bank's got $100 that I put in a savings account. Bank tries to find me in 2009, 10, 11, 12, 13. After 5 years of trying to find me, they consider it abandoned and turn it over to the state. Then we realized about a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, that our five-year period was larger than any of our neighbors. Our neighbors all had three-year rules. And so if we changed our law to a three-year, then in 2013, November 2013, we'd get all that five-year property. We'd also get four-year-old property. We'd also get three-year-old property, all in that 1 year. Now, next year, we'll just get three-year-old property, and from that point forward, always three-year-old property. But in this 1 year, now suddenly the accounts that were established in 08, 09, and 10 all are presumed abandoned, and so we get three times the number. Now, how do we estimate that? You just can't take 1 year and multiply by three because more people are found in that extra 2 years. And so it goes down. And also the other thing that caused problems for us is that some of the banks in the nation restructured. They consolidated subsidiaries into larger banks. They moved their home bank location, some into South Dakota. And so as all that was changing, we can't look at our history based on what we've been receiving because the payers suddenly were changing their nature. And so the two things that happened that caused this big bulge to occur this year were the changing nature of the banks, how they consolidated and moved their home charters around, and the fact that we had five, 4, and 3 year property, 3 year old property, all be presumed abandoned this year. And yeah, I wish we could have pegged that a little bit better. I'm happy we underpegged it and didn't overpeg it.
How excited were you to find that windfall, though, and know how helpful that could be to the state?
I was very pleased because we'd already met with some legislative leaders and appropriators and said things don't look very good. And I related at the beginning of the budget speech what we are facing in early October as we looked at the revenues we'd received and the 1.6 statutory increase and the carve-out for Building South Dakota, all those things that were in law that drove a certain amount of expenses, and the revenue wasn't there. It was about $20 million short, and so it was not looking very good. We wouldn't have to freeze anything, or we wouldn't have to cut things, but the increases available would be very modest. So we are very pleased. Now, David, you've been patient.
Go ahead, David.
Sure. Staying on the same subject, if you talk about the unclaimed property, exactly how much of a surprise was this? How much do you know was coming? What was the surprise, and what and when did you realize exactly that the numbers are going to be basically an order of magnitude different than the way things have been in the past?
We really didn't know until the payment was made in November. It was early November when the it's November 1 is the deadline. There's some banks that pay by within the week before, but the big banks pay on the due date because they manage their cash very closely.
But what use of the payment? Was this primarily just one big payment that made the difference?
There were two banks that made up the vast majority of it. We got about $125 million total. Two banks made up $122
million. Governor, you... Sorry.
Go ahead.
You obviously have a firm idea about how you want this one-time money spent. That's your vision. What is your sense from the legislators themselves? Are they behind you on that, or do you find that they might have different ideas how they want this one-time money spread out?
I would say that the legislators I've had a chance to talk to generally support many of the concepts. I think they like the idea of reducing debt and at the same time freeing up ongoing expenses. That's very appealing because it appeals to your conservative fiscal side that we're making our balance sheet better, more stable because we have less debt. At the same time, we're freeing up ongoing expenses that we can offer to our constituents who are asking for more. So they like that aspect of it. Some of the other one-time expenditures I proposed, the ones beyond the major two, three, or four, I'm not sure what kind of support they'll have. We'll see.
Now, Governor, just following up on one of the things that you said earlier, that it is your plan is not the plan, it's the first plan. But if some of these, and you said they were generally supportive of most of it, but if they come in with, you know, what is going to be your threshold, if you will, is if they come in January with ideas for the $70 million, you know, what is your threshold? What is your, you know, what are you going to be looking at if they come in with things that may not be what you had thought of or that you might not think is supportive of that? I mean, what's your threshold going to be when they bring in ideas?
Well, I think I need to be open to all ideas. I'm not the only guy with good ideas in the House. And so there may be some legislators that have ideas that are better than mine, that I like better than mine. They might propose alternatives that I think are improvements. So I really can't prejudge how I'll react to an alternative till I understand what the alternative is.
Is there right now anything you would think of that you could support?
alternatives? Well, again, I don't know what they are. I do think I tried to understand from the legislature things that they valued. I know they value building South Dakota, so I offered a way to keep money in that fund and pre-fund it with a pretty healthy allocation so that I respected what they put together last year and respect the recipients who maybe are counting on some of those funds. I know the legislature is interested, for example, in paying off the cement plant liability because they've been nicking away at that the last two sessions. So I knew this would appeal to many of them who came forward with that, or when I came forward with this one, to pay it off in full. I think it'll also be appealing that if we pay it off in full and then merge it in to the South Dakota retirement system, we don't have to worry about a change in market value creating two problems. And we also can invest it better because when you've got a fund that is failing, you have cash payouts that are required, especially a frozen plan that's paying out a fixed group of retirees. So you know that your cash payout is never going to, it's going to keep on going out, but you'll never have increases coming in. Think of our state retirement system. People that are working for the state right now, they're contributing to the plan. And then retirees are receiving money out of the plan. In this cement plant retirement fund, it's just retirees. It's nothing but outgo. And so as you get closer to payments, you have to resort to more liquidity and more cash. And that generally means a lower rate of return. And so consequently, it becomes kind of a spiral. You have to invest to pay out more. And because you have to invest to pay out more, your return is lower. And thus, you have to invest still shorter. So it's really a catch-22. As we merge it with the South Dakota retirement system, some of those problems go away, and we're able to invest it more for the long term and earn better returns.
Can you talk a little bit about your thought process on the tuition freeze, and then also about the problem with employee health insurance and inmate health care costs?
Okay. I have not dived into the detail of either of those to a great degree. I knew that when I met with the Board of Regents president and the executive director earlier this year, they presented their wish list for the budget, and I knew what their priorities were. And this was one of their top priorities, a tuition freeze. And I knew also that many legislators have been contacted by the Board of Regents saying, this is our top priority. So when I looked at funding those things that our statutes require and that are driven by formulas like Medicaid, K-12, and the tech schools, it's easier to find a starting point when you've got formula-driven funding as a starting point. The Board of Regents has no such formula. They used to. They elected and asked to abandon that in favor of this other approach that we've historically used since then. But when I knew what their top priority was, then when we looked at what can we do for them, I knew I wanted to include that as a top priority because that's what they themselves wanted. I also knew it would be helpful to our students because what we pay them in the way of a tuition freeze actually ends up saving the students money. And so the regents like it, students like it. I knew it was their top priority. So that was the sort of the thinking on that. In the state health plan, it was more a matter of what our claims history has been. When we adjourned last year, we thought we had pretty well fixed the state health plan. We looked at trends, and we funded to meet what the trends indicated, and almost immediately after the legislature adjourned, claims jumped dramatically. It was almost as if people were waiting to file their claims until after the legislature adjourned. I know that's not so, but everybody got sick suddenly. So it was very irritating to me because I said, well, why? We just went to the Appropriations Committee. We just went to the legislature to fix this problem. Why did we screw up? But then Human Resources brought in the claims data. And if you look at the table and you look at the claims history right up until the adjournment, it looked like the fix made sense. The trend line was one slope, and then suddenly after adjournment, it dramatically changed to a different slope. And I don't know what all entered into that. It's just bad luck. We just happen to have more high-class claimants. You know, under the Affordable Care Act, there's no longer any limit. It used to be we had $1 million lifetime max that I, as an employee or state employees, could claim against the plan. And then that became $2 million, and now under the Affordable Care Act, there is no limit. So we have a number of employees who are $1 million claimants. And some of them have a bloodborne disease, a hemophilia, that is going to be an ongoing. It's not like they're near the end of their lives. They're going to be a very high cost health claimant for years. So it's a combination of things, I think.
Is there anyone else on the line with a question?
Yes. Governor, I want to focus in on the building South Dakota for a second.
Yes.
Is that $30 million prepayment, is that going to be an escrow, or is that a fund that's going to be paid down over the next several years?
Well, I'm not sure. I don't think we'll create a separate... Were you going to say some more, Dave?
I mean an endowment, not escrow. I misspoke.
Yeah, we're not proposing to segregate it in the way you would like the South Dakota Community Foundation. We're not planning to transfer it out of state hands. But what we propose to do, I think, is fund it in such a way using the statute so that the money doesn't get all used in 1 year, that it would be doled out over a period of years. And so it wouldn't get all consumed by a few large applicants, because I don't think that was ever intended.
So I just want to clarify on that point, because I mean, it sounds to me, and I'm presuming that you're going to disagree with me on this point, but it sounds to me like the Building South Dakota has these ongoing expenses every year, and that you're proposing setting aside $30 million in one-time money to help pay for those until that one-time money is gone, which would seem, on the face of it, to go against your firm dividing line between ongoing expenses and one-time money. Can you talk about that?
Well, in some ways, it's ongoing expense, but in other ways, if you look into the program, there's very few that are ongoing. The education part is ongoing in the sense that English as a second language is funded through this program. That was always intended to be folded into the general education formula, and that plan has not changed. We'll still fold that into the general education funding formula over time. Most of the other funds, you know, the Local Infrastructure Fund, Housing Opportunity Fund, Economic Development Partnership, the Ready Fund, those are all ad hoc funds in the form of grants to periodic applicants. So it's not like Dennis Dugard would apply to get Housing Opportunity Funds and then I'd start to be an annual payee. I'd have a housing program that I'd offer. And then there would be, if I'm deemed qualified and have a good proposal against others who might be also applying, I get a one-time grant. So you don't create a dependency or a reliance with those one-time grant dollars like you do a reliance in, say, K-12 or Medicaid, where the expenses continue to grow over the years for the same recipients. So I do see it a little bit different for that reason.
Just finally wrapping up here, if you can talk a little bit more about your decision to basically take around $90 million in one-time money and basically, through indirect motions that you talked about, turn that into $25 million in ongoing revenue. Why did you think that was the best way to go about things?
Well, it kept with the principles that I enunciated over a year ago, without foreseeing this money coming or foreseeing the modest ongoing funding growth. A year ago, I said, if we got one-time money, you should spend it in certain ways. And I reiterated that as part of the budget. You should pay off a liability, if you can, or build something, or protect something from deterioration, or endow something. And the uses that I've suggested, for the most part, I think in virtually every instance, do one of those four things. And I tried to look at doing one of those four things. For the most part, those dollars are used in ways that not only meet one of those four criteria, but also help create ongoing money that is responsive to the people who are needing and wanting more ongoing money, not one-time money.
We have time for one more question.
I'll go ahead and ask then. I paused. Nobody else jumped in. When we're talking about K-12 education, we haven't really touched on that yet, and I don't think you're going to get anybody arguing with you about having tuition rates for colleges steady or helping the technical institutes, and you funded the K-12 education at 3%. When I was walking out of the chamber, I heard a lawmaker say, well, it's good, but it's not great. So what's the rationale behind the decision of giving K-12 3%, but, you know, using these one-time monies for other things, or if you've got this, not moving it around because if times are a little bit better, you can kind of give more to those areas. What's the rationale for the 3% as opposed to 3.5% or 4% and using that one-time money elsewhere?
Well, the only way that we can afford to do the 3% in any of these areas or in a collection of areas is to utilize the one-time money in approaches that free up enough ongoing money to afford it. If it afforded 3.5%, you know, maybe we could propose that. But even using all the one-time money in pretty aggressive ways to create ongoing funding, we still don't have enough to do more than 3% in ongoing funding. Again, people want ongoing funding. They much prefer. So the vast majority of the one-time money creates that ongoing funding. You can't have both. If they want one-time money, then there's no ongoing funding created. If they want ongoing, then we have to use the one-time money to create it. And those two major moves to create ongoing funding, either created in FY15 through using Building South Dakota or prepaying all those bonds, or in FY16, we're doing it by avoiding debt in the state vet's home. And so the vast majority of that money is really driving toward that goal of improving ongoing dollars so that we can reach those 3% numbers. And to try and do more would imply that we somehow have the opportunity to do more, and I don't. If someone can invent it, I'd be interested to hear.
More fun to talk about increases rather than cuts, though, just overall.
Always more fun, yeah. Always more fun. Well, thank you, everyone.
Thank you, Governor. Okay.